Content warning. The novel featured in this episode contains depictions of abuse and violence against women, children, and the mentally ill. We often talk about a person being haunted by their past, but of course, only as a metaphor. For some, the experience is far more literal. A true act of evil can ensnare a victim in a cycle of pain and loneliness as real as any curse. But what if the perpetrator finds himself trapped in his own dark cycle? How much punishment is enough? Where does justice end and torment begin? The patient. Jander tensed, his hands reflexively balling into fists. Magic. That would explain a great deal. He fought to quell the anger that welled up inside him at the mention of the arcane arts. The elven vampire hated magic. Once it had been part of his very nature. Even now, he still had a bit of elven magic at his control. His skill with the soil was only a minor example. Over the years, however, magic had failed to aid him in truly important matters. Now he did not trust it even in good hands, and to hear that Anna had probably been the focus of some evil spell enraged him. He deliberately forced himself to be calm and listen. Has anyone tried to remove the spell? Nope, she's got no family, no one to pay for it. Jander chewed his lip nervously. If the cleric of Lathander had tried to free Anna from the magic that kept her alive all these years, he might very well kill her. Apparently the priest had the same thought. I would try, but I'm afraid to. It could be dangerous. The guard laughed, a harsh nasal sound. What kind of a life has she got now? Dead might be better. Jander's eyes narrowed in anger. Perhaps, came the voice of the priest, definitely icy now. If you took better care of your wards, this place might not be the sewer it is. I shall speak to your superior. The vampire heard the sound of the cell door opening and melted back into the shadows. He watched as the priest of Lathander strode out, inhaling the fresh air gratefully. The human was young, only in his mid-30s or so, and bore himself with a quiet grace. He wore his brown hair long, and his robes, although beautifully colored in shades of gold and pink, were simple. From his bearing and what he had said in the asylum, the priest ranked high in Jander's eyes. Besides, the elf had always favored the teachings of Lathander Morninglord, the gold-skinned god of the dawn and beginnings. At least, he had favored him up until the great darkness had fallen upon him, barring the dawn from his sight forever. Once the guard had resumed his position outside the women's ward, Jander transformed into a mist and crept inside. He went to Anna at once, gathering her in his arms and holding her tightly. Magic. Magic has done this to you. Oh, Anna. Suddenly overwhelmed by his empathy for her plight, he placed his hands on either side of her face and kissed her deeply, and started back in surprised pain, one golden hand reaching to touch his smarting, bitten lip. Anna, caught up in her frenzy, screamed and pounded the walls. As always, Jander was beside her, calming her. When the moment had passed and she looked at him, her eyes were full of remorse. Jander embraced her, tentatively, relieved, gently bridging the rift that he had unconsciously caused. He did not ever try to kiss her again. Somehow, that token of affection triggered something in her mad mind. "Who did this to you, my love?" he whispered, holding her tenderly, not expecting a response. She said, quite clearly, "Barovia." Nothing more would she reveal. Barovia. The word sat oddly on the vampire's tongue as he repeated it. Was it a person's name, or that of a place, a word in her strange language for an action or idea? He had no way of knowing. All he knew was that something or someone connected to the word Barovia was responsible for Anna's present condition. He would find out who. Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be discussing Vampire of the Mists by Christy Golden, published in 1991 by TSR Incorporated. This will be our first foray into the demiplane of dread, a world of horror known colloquially as Ravenloft. I can't tell you how excited I am to be exploring the Ravenloft series with you. I'm doubly excited because, just recently, we learned that Wizards of the Coast will be releasing a 5th edition campaign-setting sourcebook called Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft. Although the beloved 5th edition adventure module, Curse of Strahd, takes place in the Ravenloft setting, it's limited to the domain called Barovia, and it's assumed that the characters are transported to Barovia from the Forgotten Realms. This new book should allow adventurers to travel from one side of the demiplane of Dread to the other, traversing different domains ruled by different Dark Lords and battling the evil denizens within. I want to get a couple notices out of the way. First, as always, this episode will contain spoilers for the novel, so listen no further if you'd prefer to read the novel first. Second, the Curse of Strahd module is heavily inspired by the same lore upon which this novel is based. That is to say, if you're likely to play Curse of Strahd and would prefer not to have the mystery ruined for you, you might want to skip this episode. Lastly, if you enjoy this podcast and would like to hear more, you can become a sponsor by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club. Subscribers get access to exclusive bonus episodes. The list of available bonus episodes can be viewed with no commitment by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. A subscription is only $5 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Before we dive too deeply into today's novel, let's talk about what Ravenloft is. The name Ravenloft refers specifically to Castle Ravenloft, the home of an ancient and powerful vampire named Strahd von Zarevich, who rules over a land called Barovia. Strahd and Castle Ravenloft were originally created by Tracy Hickman, one of the co-creators of Dragonlance, and his wife, Laura Hickman, for an adventure module they wrote for the first edition of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. The name Ravenloft was so memorable and evocative that they chose it for the title of the adventure. This module was later expanded into its own standalone campaign setting, published for the second editions of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, titled Ravenloft. The Ravenloft campaign setting takes place on the Demiplane of Dread, a piece of the prime material plane ruled by godlike beings called the Dark Powers. Unlike Kryn or Toril, the Demiplane of Dread is not an entire planet. Imagine if Ancillon was removed from Kryn or Faerun from Toril and left floating out in its own pocket dimension, and you'll get a sense of the scope of the Demiplane of Dread. Beyond the borders of the Demiplane of Dread, there are the Mists, an endless gray void under the direct control of the Dark Powers. Side note, for consistency's sake, I will say Castle Ravenloft when referring to the actual castle located in Barovia. I will say the Demiplane of Dread when referring to the physical space of the Ravenloft campaign setting in which Barovia and the other domains exist. And I will say Ravenloft when referring to the campaign setting as a whole. An ordinary individual dwelling within a domain is unlikely to think much beyond their home domain and likely has little awareness of the true nature of the world. A few words about the Dark Powers. I describe them as godlike because of the near omnipotent power they hold over the Demiplane of Dread, but they are far more nebulous and abstract than a typical D&D deity. There are no clerics devoted to the Dark Powers, nor does anyone worship them, nor do they seem to desire followers. No one knows who they are, where they came from, or what they want. The only thing known for sure is that the Dark Powers are responsible for creating the different domains in the Demiplane of Dread and assigning Dark Lords, that's one word, to rule over them. Or perhaps they choose the Dark Lord first and then create the domain for him or her. It's not entirely clear. So what is a domain? It's a geographic area controlled by a specific Dark Lord. Each domain has a clearly delineated border which the Dark Lord cannot cross. The most famous of the domains is Barovia, the setting for Curse of Strahd, and the setting for Vampire of the Mists. It's not the largest domain, but it was the first. Barovia's Dark Lord is Strahd von Zarevich, who rules from Castle Ravenloft. So what is a Dark Lord? We'll meet one soon enough. But, as I've hinted, a Dark Lord is a ruler of a specific domain. Typically, the Dark Lord is the civil and military authority as well, but not necessarily. In theory, there can be only a single Dark Lord per domain, but there are exceptions. The Dark Lord's greatest power is the ability to close the border of their domain at will, preventing any other beings from entering or exiting their domain. The only exception to this rule are the Vistani, a nomadic people inspired by the real-world Romani. Or, perhaps I should say, inspired by the Hollywood version of the real-world Romani. We'll talk more about them later. Despite the Dark Lord's power, he or she is imprisoned within their domain to be punished for some terrible, unrepented act of evil. The punishment is uniquely tailored to each Dark Lord, who often cannot help but contribute, knowingly or unknowingly, to their own punishment. The dark powers occasionally use their own greatest weapon, the mists, to draw evildoers from other realms into the demiplane of dread, to be tormented for whatever crime they committed on their home world. There is no attempt at rehabilitation or reform. The dark powers seem to simply enjoy manipulating and frustrating evildoers simply for their own amusement. The innocent are not safe from the dark powers, but they seem to take special delight in the suffering of the guilty. I have a strong personal connection to the Ravenloft setting. When I was young, I had 3 campaign setting box sets for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. Dragonlance, obviously, Planescape, and Ravenloft. I used to spend countless hours poring over those source books and imagining the stories and adventures which might take place in those worlds. And of course, I devoured the Ravenloft novels. To this day, few genres fire my imagination quite like dark fantasy. The combination of high fantasy and horror. When I was little, I played Castlevania. As an adult, I played Dark Souls. And in between, there was Ravenloft. Ravenloft is special to me for another reason. When I was a teenager, despite owning the Dragonlance and Planescape box sets, I only ever ran Ravenloft for my D&D group. I don't honestly remember why this was. Maybe the Ravenloft modules were easier to find in my local bookstore. Maybe I just felt drawn to the setting in a different way than I was to Dragonlance. As much as I love reading Dragonlance novels, perhaps Ravenloft the game had a stronger pull for me. Maybe the looser framework of Ravenloft was simply easier to run an adventure in than the dense narrative of Dragonlance or the wild weirdness of Planescape. Regardless, Ravenloft was every bit as much a part of my childhood as Dragonlance, only in a different way. The last thing I want to say before we discuss the story itself is that Ravenloft was a major inspiration for this podcast. Originally, I had imagined myself running a literary podcast exploring lesser-known subgenres of fiction, including noir, southern gothic, and cosmic horror. I would do blocks of episodes, called seasons, each devoted to a different style of novel. One of those seasons would focus on Ravenloft as an exemplar of the dark fantasy genre. Ultimately, I decided to focus on Dungeons & Dragons-inspired novels, and here we are today, proud members of the D&D Book Club. As such, let's step together through the cold mists and into the demiplane of dread. The story of Vampire of the Mists begins in the iconic city of Waterdeep in the Forgotten Realms, in the depths of an insane asylum, where a young human woman named Anna has been confined for an unknown length of time, confined not only physically, but also confined mentally within the prison of her own madness. This asylum, in addition to being a den of lost souls, is also the feeding ground of a 700-year-old vampire named Jander Sunstar. Jander, a gold-haired, bronze-skinned, silver-eyed elf, was born in the elven land of Evermeet. From his earliest youth, Jander had a strong affinity for the light of the sun, and he came to worship Lathander, the Morning Lord, god of the dawn, as his personal patron deity. When he reached adulthood, Jander left his home to travel the world with a party of fellow adventurers, as one does when one lives in a fantasy role-playing game. It's either that or be an NPC, and nobody wants that. Jander was a member of a gang called the Silver Six. In addition to Jander, there was Kellion the Ranger, Gideon the Cleric, Lyria the Wizard, Trumper the Rogue, and Alanora, who will die before we ever find out what her class was. The group was staying at an inn, ominously named the Swan Song, in the town of Merrydale when Kellion the Ranger suddenly took ill. The only clue to his sickness was the mysterious appearance of 2 small puncture wounds on his neck. Despite living in a world where vampires are every bit as real as elves and dwarves, no one in the group suspected a vampire bite. The next morning, Kellion was dead. Alanora was the next to fall ill, and Gideon's healing miracles could do nothing to save her. And more soon followed. The people of Merrydale were getting sick and dying, apparently of the same mysterious malady. It was only a matter of time before the townsfolk began to get suspicious that the newcomers might have brought the disease with them. In their minds, the Silver Six should have been called the Silver Six. That's S-I-C-K-S. Sorry, it worked better on paper. Anyway, the local authorities placed the town under quarantine, and the Silver remaining 4 were trapped in the town. That night, Those who had died rose from the dead as, surprise, surprise, vampires, and attacked. Jander was even forced to kill his former friend, Eleonora, before the adventurers managed to find refuge in a holy temple with the remaining citizens of Merrydale. The next day, the adventurers set out to find the places where the vampires rested during the day and destroy them, before sheltering in the temple again at night. The day after that, the adventurers continued their grim work, this time separating to cover more ground. At night, Jander, Trumper, and Lyria convened again at the temple, but Gideon the cleric never returned. The next morning, the adventurers left the town for good, and the three survivors separated. Jander decided to return to his homeland of Evermeet. One night, while he played his flute alone in the wilderness, he was approached by none other than his friend Gideon, whom he had thought lost. Jander was overjoyed to see him right up until the moment Gideon sank his fangs into Jander's neck. Gideon had become a thrall of a master vampire named Cassiar, the same vampire who had masterminded the attack on Merrydale. Cassiar and Gideon had been following Jander for quite some time. Cassiar was apparently fascinated with the idea of turning an elf into a vampire, something which had apparently never been done. Jander awoke the next night, buried in the earth. He pulled himself up to the surface only to learn the truth of what had been done to him. Knowing he must be hungry, Jander's new master offered him a young boy for breakfast. Unable to resist his hunger and unable to resist his master's will, Jander fed upon the helpless child. For a century, Jander served Cassiar until he at last gained enough strength to resist his master's will and destroy him. On his own for the first time in 100 years, Jander traveled to the city of Waterdeep, where the last surviving member of the Silver Six, Lyria the Wizardess, still lived. Jander had sought out Lyria to ask her to cure him of the vampiric curse. Lyria told him that there was no cure, no way to undo what Jander had become. The only way to escape his condition was by ending his unnatural life. In a rage of disappointment, Jander attacked Lyria, only to be driven away by the holy emblem of Lathander, the god whom Jander had once followed. Since that time, Jander has been living alone in the wilderness beyond Waterdeep. He lives quietly, or unlives, I guess. I don't know the proper terminology. Tending his garden of night-blooming flowers. He sustains himself on the blood of animals, and that is usually enough. But not quite. Jander cannot survive without partaking of more nourishing fare from time to time. To this end, he occasionally visits the lunatic asylum in Waterdeep to drain a pint or two from the poor patients who live there. He never takes enough blood to cause serious harm, and his victims are barely aware that anything has happened to them. This is how Jander exists. His existence isn't a happy one, but it's at least peaceful. Until he meets Anna. Anna is a patient/inmate at the asylum where Jander likes to feed. She's filthy when he meets her, but she's beautiful underneath all that filth. And she's nearly catatonic, but that doesn't stop Jander from falling in love with her. He makes her care his mission, and she becomes his reason for existing. He can't take her out of the asylum because he reasons there would be no one to care for her during the daylight hours. Instead, he visits her often, bringing her food from the outside world as well as gifts. Anna seems to possess some small awareness. She is able to tell him her name, and she calls him Sir. One day, a young cleric of the god Lathander visits the asylum. While eavesdropping on the conversation between the cleric and the guard, Jander learns that Anna has been at the asylum for 100 years and has not changed in all that time. The cleric assesses her and determines that her condition is magical in nature, not physical, and there's nothing to be done. That night, Anna endures one of the violent fits she is occasionally prone to, and Jander comforts her. When she calms down, Jander asks her who did this to her. In response, Anna says only one word, Barovia. 30 years pass, and Anna does not age. Jander visits her one night and discovers that she is ill with a fever. He doesn't know how to treat illness since he hasn't been sick in centuries, so he goes to find a cleric. As fate would have it, the cleric he finds is the same cleric he saw decades earlier, now decades older. Jander asks him to come see Anna, but, like before, there's nothing the cleric can do for her. Anna is slowly dying. In desperation, Jander does the one thing he can. He decides to turn Anna into a vampire. He drinks her blood until she is at the point of death, then offers her his blood to drink. But Anna refuses. She will not drink Jander's blood, despite his entreaties. Anna dies in Jander's arms. With the loss of his beloved, Jander loses his mind. The rage he has kept buried for centuries explodes from within. He transforms himself into a golden-haired wolf and slaughters every inmate and every guard at the asylum, returning to the form of a blood-soaked elf only after everyone is dead. Jander stares in horror at the carnage all around him. Overcome with grief and remorse, Jander flees the asylum and wanders into the forest. He prays to the gods to give him the means to gain revenge against whoever was responsible for Anna's affliction. As if in answer to his prayers, a mist begins to form around him, and soon Jander is engulfed in an impenetrable fog. When the fog finally dissipates, Jander is in a land he has never seen before. Far from the city of Waterdeep, far from the Sword Coast, far from the world of Toril itself. Jander spots a village nearby and decides to investigate. Inside an inn called the Wolf's Den, Jander learns that Barovia is not a person, but a place. It is, in fact, the name of the land in which he has found himself. It's also the name of this particular village. He is able to sense that a heavy pall lies over Barovia village, like a shadow on the heart of every townsperson. A young woman named Olya has recently died of a fever, but that's not the source of the town's misery. As Jander listens to the people around the inn talk, he hears an unusual name spoken only in frightened or hateful whispers, Strahd. He meets a young man named Petya, a Vistani singer and entertainer. Vistani are a secretive tribe of nomads who travel Barovia and beyond, earning their way by performing and by reading fortunes. However, the Vistani are mistrusted by the common folk of Barovia village for the same ignorant reasons that any group mistrusts a minority it doesn't understand. One of the patrons of the inn plants a bag of coins on Petya, then claims he's a thief and holds up the coins as evidence after a quick search. Petya is taken out to the square to be flogged or worse. A young woman named Anastasia, who happens to be madly in love with Petya, tries to help him, but she is pulled back by her father. Her father is Boris Kartoff, the burgomaster, which is a Barovian way of saying mayor or local lord. Kartoff knew his daughter was sneaking off for midnight trysts with the Vistani and had come to the inn to confront him when this whole kerfuffle started. Kartoff doesn't care about a few stolen coins, but he cares about keeping his daughter completely under his control and decides to use the bogus charge as an excuse to lynch the young man. Jander isn't about to let this happen, however. He's kind of taken a shine to Petya. There happens to be some wolves lurking around. In Barovia, you're never far from a wolf. And he uses his vampiric telepathy to send the wolf to save Petya. The wolves attack the men who had accosted Petya and drive them off, including the burgomaster. When it's safe, Anastasia makes Jander a promise of friendship, and Petya declares that he owes Jander his life. Now, sadly, the two young lovers must part. Anastasia back home to get beaten some more, and Petya to join his family at their camp. He invites Jander to join him. As the two walk together into the wilderness beyond the village, Jander asks Petya about the person called Strahd. He learns that Strahd is actually Count Strahd von Zarevich, the Lord of Barovia. At the Vistani camp, Jander meets Petya's sister, Marushka. She invites Jander into her wagon to give him a free fortune-telling. Using tarot-like cards, Marushka reveals the story of Jander's youth in Evermeet, his time adventuring, and that he recently lost the person he loved. The final two cards look to the future. The first card is the Tower, which depicts Castle Ravenloft itself. Marushka is disturbed at the sight of it. Of all the cards in the deck, this is the most ominous. It suggests chaos and destruction to come. The last card revealed is the Sun, which implies a kind of redemption, or perhaps at the very least, justice. Jander spends some time among the Vistani, listening to their songs and dancing with them. The night's festivities end for Jander when he meets Madame Eva, Petya and Marushka's grandmother and matriarch of this particular Vistani group. Although she is grateful Jander saved her grandchildren's lives, she knows what he is and orders him to depart. When he is gone, she tells Petya and Marushka what he truly is, and Petya goes to warn Anastasia. Jander, meanwhile, goes to spend the day sleeping in a cave. While he sleeps, he dreams of Anna. She appears to him as a vision, beautiful and clean and sane, and charges Jander with finding the one responsible for the magical curse which had been inflicted upon her. That evening, Jander wakes up to find a carriage waiting for him, a carriage with horses and no driver. Jander climbs inside, and the carriage propels itself by magic deeper into Barovia. It stops at an ancient wooden bridge covering a deep ravine, the bridge leading to the entrance of the enormous, foreboding ruin of Castle Ravenloft. Once on the other side, Jander approaches the entranceway. The doors open, and Jander is invited inside by a voice echoing from within, the voice of the master of the castle. Jander enters, and at last we meet Count Strahd. He is a handsome, well-dressed, powerfully built man with a haughty manner, but also a blazing intensity in his eyes. There is immediate friction between the two, but mutual interest as well. Now, unless you're for some reason listening to this podcast without knowing anything about Dungeons & Dragons, you know Strahd is a vampire, but it takes Jander a little while to catch on. Strahd leads Jander through his dilapidated castle into the one nice room in the whole place, Strahd's study. Three things in particular attract Jander's interest: a ruined fresco with an unreadable inscription, a statue which appears to have been deliberately decapitated, and a door leading to an inner study, Strahd's personal sanctum. The two vampires engage in a bit of back and forth. Jander asks Strahd if he knew anything about Anna, but Strahd says it's a very common name and doesn't ring any bells, bat pun intended. Strahd is impressed by Jander's power, including his ability to command Strahd's own wolves. Jander is much older than Strahd, who was in his middle years when he died and has only been a vampire for a century, but there is a worldliness to Strahd that Jander, having spent 500 years living in a cave, is somewhat lacking. Strahd was also an experienced warrior in life and has become a skilled magic user after death. Strahd also has a small army of undead servants, as well as female vampires, who are captive thralls under Strahd's power, the same way Jander was once a thrall of Cassiar. The simmering tension between the two vampires nearly turns to violence when Jander asks Strahd, hypothetically, what Strahd might do if Jander revealed his true nature to his subjects. Strahd coolly counters that he would destroy Jander. Jander points out that Strahd does not have the power to destroy him, even if he is lord of this land. At this, Strahd erupts in anger, informing Jander that he is not merely the lord of Barovia, he is Barovia. He and the land are connected by a mystical link. There cannot be one without the other. But Strahd quickly calms down and invites Jander to stay with him. He gives Jander free reign of the castle except for his private study, which is magically locked anyway. Strahd politely offers Jander blood from one of his slaves, but Jander demurs, claiming he only feeds off animals with all the self-righteousness of a militant vegan. Strahd teases him, suggesting the animals of Barovia will not be enough to satisfy him. Jander goes off into the woods to hunt, and, sure enough, the animals satisfy his appetite about as well as tofu on Thanksgiving. Upon his return to the castle, Strahd sends him room service in the form of a pretty young woman. Jander feeds upon her, but not so much to end her life. Afterwards, Jander dreams of Anna. Once again, she appears as she might have in her prime. This time, she has a new mission for Jander: find the one who destroyed her mind and avenge the wrong that was committed against her. That night, Jander and Strahd go out hunting together. They happen upon of lost travelers who seem to be from Jander's homeworld of Toril. This isn't as unlikely as it seems. People do sometimes wind up in Barovia from other worlds, like Jander did. Jander can barely control his impulses this time and nearly drains a man dry. The only one unharmed is a young boy, whom Strahd offers to Jander for dessert. Jander takes pity on the boy and decides to spare him. Looking up at the golden-haired, bronze-skinned, silver-eyed elf who has just saved him, the traumatized boy mistakes Jander for the god of the morning, Lathander himself. Jander begins to settle into quote-unquote life at Castle Ravenloft. Strahd has an extensive library, and Jander begins to read his way through it book by book, hoping to learn something that will help him in his search for the source of Anna's madness. He also begins to play the flute again, something he hasn't done for hundreds of years. It turns out that Strahd is a musician as well. His instrument of choice is the organ. This discovery leads to an impromptu jam session in the castle chapel, with only the lonely skeletal guardian for an audience. Jander asks Strahd how he became a vampire, and Strahd tells him the story of his transformation. Once, Strahd was a great general who fought valiantly for noble causes, but he was a victim of his own success. The wars ended, and Strahd became obsolete, ruling over ignorant peasants while the years slipped by and he grew more bitter. His life changed when he met a beautiful young woman named Tatiana, but before the two could be wed, she was seduced by a younger and handsomer and definitely more fun dude. His heart poisoned by rage and jealousy, Strahd prayed for revenge. His prayer was answered by Death himself. Death would give Strahd the power to obtain the revenge he sought, as well as immortality, so he could remain with his beloved forever. Strahd agreed. Death transformed him into a vampire, and he took his revenge upon his rival. Sadly, revenge murder schemes rarely go as intended. Tatiana was so overcome with horror at what Strahd had done that she committed suicide to join her lover in death. Strahd was immortal, but alone, and his land Barovia had been taken from the world where it belonged to this strange new demiplane. Jander listens to the story with interest, sensing it is true, but also that there is some truth missing. 10 years pass. On one seemingly ordinary day in Barovia Village, a young priest is performing his daily rituals in the town square. His name is Martin Pelker, but he has had the nickname Mad Martin ever since he was a child and claimed he was rescued by the god Lathander Morninglord himself. Now Martin styles himself as Brother Martin, priest of the god of light. While Brother Martin is away, a young boy named Sasha comes to Martin's church. Sasha is none other than the son of Anastasia and Petya, and he has come on a mission to steal holy objects of protection from the church. He and his friend Kolya, the baker's apprentice, sneak inside and remove pink wooden discs, symbols of Lathander, as well as bottles of holy water. That evening, Sasha tells his mother he is going to stay with Kolya, while Kolya tells his parents he's going to stay with Sasha. In fact, the two are planning a camp out of sorts within a ring of protective stones beyond the village. Sasha has been hearing stories of vampires and werewolves his entire life, but he's never actually seen one. He plans to stay awake all night in hopes of catching a glimpse of one of the monsters that supposedly stalk this land. The discs and holy water and protective stones are there to ensure he's safe from whatever might be out there. As it so happens, there is something out there. Strahd and Jander and the nameless lady vampires. Jander, not wanting to see the children harmed, suggests to Strahd that they move along. Strahd agrees. He has something else in mind anyway. The group head to the house of Burgomaster Kartoff. Kartoff, Strahd explains, has been skimming off the top of his tax collections, and nobody f**ks with Strahd's money. Jander thinks Strahd is just going to kill the Burgomaster, but that's not so. While Jander feeds upon Ludmilla, Anastasia's sister, Strahd and his women viciously slaughter every person in the house. Anastasia, whom Jander once swore to keep safe, dies in Jander's arms. To cover their tracks, Strahd sets the house on fire and the vampires depart. Within the circle of stones, Sasha notices the light from the fire. He and Kolya return to the village and Sasha discovers, to his horror, that it's his house that's burning. The villagers blame the curse Petya once laid upon Burgomaster Kartoff, but Sasha, exploring the charred ruins, knows it was vampires. Brother Martin is the only one who believes him. He tells the boy what must be done. Together, the two stake the victims to prevent them from rising as vampires themselves. The last person they find is Sasha's aunt Ludmilla, with two bite marks in her neck, indicating that she's been fed upon. To their great astonishment, Ludmilla has survived the attack. The years roll by at Castle Ravenloft. Jander has made restoring Castle Ravenloft his personal project, particularly the ruined fresco he first noticed when he arrived at the castle. He has long ceased to dream of Anna, believing her madness was not caused by some malicious act, but simply a result of living in a world of horrors. Until one day when he dreams of her again, this time looking filthier and crazier than she did in the asylum. She is more impatient and more demanding than ever. She reminds Jander that her soul will never be able to rest until he has found what happened to her and avenges her at last. Meanwhile, Count Strahd has made a new friend, a werewolf named Katrina, Trina to her friends. Strahd was drawn to her beauty, but also to her innate bloodthirstiness and an enjoyment of killing to match his own. He's grown bored of his subservient thralls, and having a living, breathing woman around makes things more interesting. Trina is crushing hard on Strahd. Jander likes Trina well enough, but finds her sadly naive in her feelings for Strahd. One day, she breaks down in tears, and Jander takes her in his arms to comfort her. At that moment, Strahd arrives, his eyes burning red with an unspeakable jealous rage. Then he calms down. It was only a moment, but Jander is reminded of what lurks just behind Strahd's easy smile. One evening, Strahd takes Jander into the village to a party hosted by the new burgomaster, who also happens to be married to Ludmilla Kartoff. Strahd rarely attends these functions, but he feels he needs to be seen to remind the people that he hasn't gone anywhere. During the party, Jander is accosted by Father Martin, who, seeing Jander and believing him to be Lathander incarnate, falls to his knees in front of him. Jander insists he's not a god, but Martin refuses to believe him. Brother Sasha, who he last saw as a child staking his own mother, has to drag Martin away. Little Sasha has grown into adulthood. After the death of his family, Sasha became brother, now father, Martin's protege, and is now a priest of Lathander as well. After escorting Martin back to the church, he returns to speak with Jander. He has figured out what Jander is and who Jander is. After a brief conversation between the priest and the vampire, Sasha is unsatisfied. He cannot understand how this blood-drinking monster and the man who saved his father's life could be the same person. As he is thinking this over in private, the maid from the church, Sister Katya, arrives in a panic to fetch him back. Katya was an orphan girl hired by Martin and Sasha to keep the church tidy and tend to other womanly duties. She is a kind, sweet, beautiful young woman, and it didn't take long for Sasha to fall in love with her. But at the moment, he has more in his mind than making googly eyes. Sasha follows Katya back to the church. Martin has apparently gone mad for real. He claims he has seen his god, and his god is calling him home. Sasha puts the last pieces of the puzzle together, realizing the role Jander played in Martin's conversion to the faith of the Morning Lord. Then, with Sasha and Katya by his side, Martin dies. Some nights later, Jander goes to visit Strahd's human cattle to bring them food. Apparently, he doesn't trust zombies enough to properly care for them. In the dungeons, he finds a young girl. Jander decides to set her free, figuring Strahd won't miss one little blood bag. As he's bringing her to the village, he crosses paths with Sasha out in the woods. Sasha demands Jander give him the child, which Jander is totally fine with. He asks Sasha to do him a favor, however, to look to the church records for any mention of a girl named Anna born around the year 333. Sasha agrees, and the two part ways. Walking back to the village, however, Sasha catches a vampirus in the act of feeding on a young woman. Sasha ties the little girl to a tree so she doesn't wander off, although I couldn't help but think about the goat in Jurassic Park. Then Sasha attacks, chasing the vampire off and saving the young woman. In the scuffle, however, his hood falls back and his face is revealed. This is important, since vampire hunting is typically a hobby you don't advertise. She recognizes him as the priest from the village. She introduces herself as Liesel, an honest thief, and offers to help Sasha in his mission, right before she passes out from blood loss. Sasha and Katya take care of Liesel and nurse her back to health. Once she is recovered, Liesel tries to convince Sasha to let her join him as a vampire hunter, but he refuses. One night, while Sasha is out hunting, he is nearly killed by one of Strahd's thralls. Liesel, who has been secretly following him, saves him not a moment too soon. Sasha chastises her for her recklessness before being distracted by a strange sight. Sister Katya, now Sasha's fiancé, is wandering through the forest alone, seemingly insensible. Sasha and Liesel take Katya back to her cottage. Apparently, Katya has been suffering from terrible nightmares of being hunted. But that's not the worst of it. Katya has begun to sleepwalk as well, venturing out into the dangerous forest in the dead of night. Back at the castle, Jander is working on the restoration of the fresco while Trina the werewolf watches on, bored. The Count has been teaching her some simple spells, and she is eager to practice and show off. She casually mentions to Jander that she has learned a spell to unlock magical doors. Jander realizes that perhaps he can use Trina to open the magically sealed door leading into the secret part of Strahd's study. He tricks Trina into opening the door, then sends her away on some imaginary errands while he explores within. Xander isn't too concerned about Strahd interrupting, though. The Count has been disappearing for weeks at a time, searching, Xander supposes, for the vampire hunter who's been killing his thralls. Behind the door, Xander finds a table that appears to have been set for a feast. A wedding feast, judging by the remains of a wedding cake complete with a little toy bride and groom. The entire table, feast and all, is covered with a thick layer of dust. He sees a painting depicting three men. The eldest is clearly Strahd, along with another man in his middle years, the middle brother presumably, and the youngest brother wearing what appears to be a holy pendant around his neck. Everything here seems frozen in time, except for a small table. Upon the table, set upon a clean white cloth, are pieces of women's jewelry, candles, one old and one new book. Hanging up on the wall above the table is a painting likewise covered by a clean white cloth. When he removes the cloth, Xander finds a painting of a man and a woman. The man's face has been slashed to ribbons of hanging canvas and is unrecognizable. But Xander recognizes the woman immediately. It is his beloved Anna. Stunned, determined to understand, Xander begins to read the books. The books are Strahd's personal journals, and they tell a horrific story of jealousy and murder. Strahd was once a great warrior, as Xander already knew, but there is so much more to the story of how Strahd became undead. First, the quote-unquote rival, who quote-unquote stole Strahd's beloved, was Strahd's own younger brother, Sergei. He had come to live with Strahd at Castle Ravenloft after the wars ended, and had fallen in love with a beautiful and kind-hearted village girl named Tatiana, and she with him. But when Strahd first lay eyes upon Tatiana, he became obsessed with her. His envy towards Sergei for his youth, his good looks, his charm, and now the love of Tatiana deepened into a furious hatred. As Sergei and Tatiana's wedding approached, Strahd became more and more desperate to possess her. One night, while searching through a book of spells for the means to compel Tatiana to fall in love with him, Strahd heard a voice speaking into his mind and soul. When Strahd asked who was speaking, this was the answer he received. I am every nightmare every creature has ever had. I am the dark thoughts of murder and treachery, of fear and lust and obscenity and violation. I am the cutting word that kills the soul and the bloody knife that kills the body. I am the poison at the bottom of the cup, the noose around the thief's neck, the cry of the wronged and the shriek of the tortured. I am the lie. I am the black pit of madness. I am death. And all things worse. By the way, that's Death with a capital D. Strahd made a pact that night with Death himself. On the night of Sergei and Tatiana's wedding, Strahd went to his brother in private. He reproached his brother, asking him why he did not simply become a priest as family tradition dictated the youngest son should. Had he done so, he could never have married, and all of this could have been avoided. Suddenly, wielding an accursed dagger, Strahd stabbed his own brother in the heart. As Sergei died, never knowing why his brother had killed him, Strahd licked the blood from the blade, then drank the blood which spilled from the open wound it had created. His bargain with Death was complete, and Strahd became a vampire. Strahd went in search of Tatiana to tell her the good news that her fiancé was dead and now she could marry his creepy older brother. Instead of thanking him profusely, much to his surprise, Tatiana fled from him. Strahd pursued her like a predatory animal, but Tatiana threw herself from the wall of the castle, plunging into the mists below. Consumed with grief and rage, Strahd slaughtered every single wedding guest. The cake would never be eaten. But that's not quite the end of the story. Barovia had separated from whatever land it had once been a part of and moved somehow to the strange new demiplane to become the first of the dark domains of Ravenloft. Then Strahd heard of a young woman in the village who was the mirror image of Tatiana. Strahd sought her out, sought her hand in marriage, but her own father killed her rather than let Strahd have her. Years passed. Another girl was born in the village who grew into another Tatiana. Her name was Olya, and she died of a fever before Strahd could have her. But it has been a generation since that, and Strahd believes another Tatiana must now live somewhere in Barovia. He has been seeking her out. That's why he keeps disappearing, not because he's searching for the vampire hunter, but because he's searching for Tatiana reincarnated. Xander has finally put the pieces together. Anna, his Anna, was Tatiana. She had tried to end her life, but the mists had taken her from Barovia to Toril. What Strahd had done to her had driven her mad and trapped her within the prison of her own mind. She had been forced to relive the horror over and over. She had died in the asylum of a fever the same night Olya died in Barovia, the same night Jander slaughtered the inmates at the asylum, the same night the mists took him. Jander now knows Strahd is responsible for what happened to Anna. He is consumed with rage and a desire for revenge, but, more importantly, he knows that avenging Anna will break her curse and allow her to rest peacefully. He goes to visit Brother Sasha and tells the young cleric what Strahd is and what must be done. Sasha agrees to help, and the two search for a means to destroy Strahd. He is no ordinary vampire, and ordinary means will not suffice. In the village, Sasha recalls an old folktale about a hero named Pavel Ivanovich, the heir of the sun, who used a piece of the sun itself to hold the evil of the land at bay. But the piece of the sun was stolen by the darkness and taken to the darkest place in the land, which Sasha assumes is Castle Ravenloft. He visits the Vistani encampment and meets his aunt Marushka, now the leader of the Vistani tribe. She divines that the answer to Sasha's questions will be told through stone. Meanwhile, at the castle, Jander reads through Strahd's books of Barovian history and learns of a holy artifact called the Holy Symbol of Ravenkind, which was created to protect the von Zarovich family and was used by the High Priest during Strahd's campaigns as a mortal. Sasha, Liesl, and Jander meet and compare notes. They decide to attempt to speak to the stones within the same ancient circle that Sasha and his friend Kolya once camped out in, hoping to see a vampire, the night Strahd killed the Kartoff family. Sasha casts a holy spell and the stones speak to the group. Stones make it clear that the piece of the sun once entrusted to Pavel Ivanovich and the holy symbol of Ravenkind are one and the same, and that it rests near those it was meant to protect, i.e. the von Zarovich family. The next day, Sasha says goodbye to Katya and meets up with Liesl. Together, the two travel to Castle Ravenloft, armed with holy weapons. Inside the castle, the vampire hunters meet up with Jander. He guides them to the chapel, where a solitary skeletal warrior keeps watch over the entrance to the tombs below the castle. In the tombs, the hunters find Strahd's thralls asleep in their stone coffins. One by one, they dispatch the lady vampires, Jander removing the coffin lids, Sasha staking them, and Liesl beheading them. At last, the group comes to the crypt of Strahd himself. Had Strahd lived and died as a normal man, he would have been buried here. As it is, he has made this his resting place during the daylight hours. However, the Count himself is not to be found, which is as Jander had expected. The trio searches the castle for the holy artifact from the stories, but without much luck. The three reconvene in the chapel to try to determine what to do next. That's when Jander notices something that he's seen 1,000 times before without a second thought. The skeletal guardian of the chapel is wearing the same silver medallion around his neck that Strahd's youngest brother wore in the painting of the von Zarovich boys. This skeletal guardian was once Sergei. When Strahd killed him, he was wearing the holy symbol of Ravenkind as part of his wedding costume, and he's been puttering around the castle, still wearing it, all this time, right under Jander's nose. Jander kills Sergei the skeleton, not out of anger, but to release him from undeath. Sasha claims the holy symbol. The group knows this is a big win for their undertaking, and Sasha casually mentions that Madame Marushka was correct in her fortune-telling. Jander is horrified. He knows the Vistani are Strahd's spies. They would have warned Strahd about what the vampire hunters were planning. This has all been an elaborate trap. And right on cue, Strahd appears. But Strahd is not alone. He has Katya with him as his hostage. He orders Sasha to surrender the medallion to him. Sasha calls out to his beloved, knowing he cannot let her die, even if it means failure. But Jander is confused. It isn't Katya that Strahd is holding, it's Trina the werewolf. Actually, it's both. Katya and Trina have been the same person all along. Trina laughs at Sasha and explains that she was the one who led Strahd's thralls to him to be slain, so that she might have Strahd all to herself. It was an accident that Sasha saw her in the woods that night, and she pretended to be sleepwalking so as not to give the game away. Trina attacks Liesl, and Jander attacks Strahd. In the ensuing battle, Liesl is nearly killed, but Sasha is able to drive Trina off using a silver dagger. Jander takes hold of the sun medallion and immediately begins to burn through his hand. Jander ignores the pain as he tells Strahd of what truly became of Tatiana after her supposed suicide. Strahd claims he loves Tatiana, but Jander knows this is false. Strahd could never love anyone. Jander prays to Lathander the Morning Lord and is able to channel the power of the sun through the medallion. Strahd takes the blast of sunlight full force. He's very nearly destroyed, and an ordinary vampire would have been, but Strahd is able to cast a spell and escape moments before destruction. He will go off to a secret hiding place to recuperate while the ever-faithful Trina watches over him. And that's when Jander has a moment of clarity. He could never destroy Strahd. The dark powers which rule Barovia would never allow it. He begins to see that he was brought to Barovia for a reason, to be yet another pawn in the dark powers game with Strahd. He thinks of the dreams he's had about Anna. She was a kind, loving, forgiving soul. She never would have wanted Jander to be consumed by revenge. The dreams were sent to him by the dark powers to goad him on. They wanted to trap Jander in the same cycle of pain and loss in which they trapped Strahd and Tatiana. Jander sees what must happen. He and Strahd will remain at war forever as Jander pursues a vengeance which can never be satisfied. There is nothing he can do to destroy Strahd. There is nothing he can do to save Tatiana. But he can refuse to play a part in the tragedy the dark powers have composed. Jander lays down to rest in the path of the rising sun. He tells Sasha and Liesl to do what they can to foil Strahd's schemes and keep his evil in check, but to do so for the sake of the innocent, not for revenge. The sun rises, and Jander is consumed by the light of the morning. Alrighty, so that was Vampire of the Mists by Christy Golden. To appreciate this novel fully, you need to understand the time when it was published. This was the year 1991, 30 years ago this year. Vampires were the biggest thing in pop horror. The mid to late 80s had seen a slew of now classic vampire movies. Fright Night, Vampire Hunter D, Near Dark, The Lost Boys, and of course my personal favorite, Monster Squad. Bram Stoker's Dracula and Buffy the Vampire Slayer were only a year away. Castlevania was one of the most popular franchises for the NES. And within the tabletop game genre, 1991 is the same year the first edition of Vampire the Masquerade would be published. Yet none of these properties could compare, well, maybe Buffy, to the ultimate vampire powerhouse of the 80s and early 90s, Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles. Forget about Bram Stoker and Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. The vampire as we know it would not exist today without her far-reaching influence. She created a brand new archetype when she dreamed into existence the greatest of all vampire anti-heroes, Lestat. He was immortal, powerful, beautiful, charming, sensual, stylish, and sophisticated, like the vampires of old, but with a decidedly modern panache. Lestat fit into 80s New Orleans in a way Dracula never could have. Lestat even became a famous rock star. I would also say that Anne Rice created a second vampire archetype as well, the brooding, reluctant vampire, epitomized by Lestat's partner in Louis, kind of a prototype of Jander. So it's perfectly natural that Dungeons & Dragons would seek to capitalize upon the 80s vampire revival by creating a campaign setting around its most famous vampire character, Count Strahd von Zarovich. And what better way to introduce that character to the reading public than with a tie-in novel? Thus was Vampire of the Mists born. I'd like to start my analysis by talking about what makes this novel somewhat atypical, especially within the Dungeons & Dragons genre. Unlike most D&D novels, Vampire of the Mists does not reflect, pun very much intended, the game itself. This isn't a story about a band of noble heroes on a mission to defeat evil, or ranging far and wide across the land in search of adventure or treasure. There's no epic battles or set-piece encounters with great and powerful monsters. There isn't even a typical protagonist. Jander Sunstar is a 700-year-old vampire who spends his nights gardening, reading, and playing the flute. Not your typical action hero. But that's okay. It's not really that type of story. After all, this isn't fantasy, it's fantasy horror, and a badass Mary Sue like Drisda Erden wouldn't necessarily work in a horror setting. In a horror story, the protagonist needs to be at a serious disadvantage to the evil he or she is confronting, or else there's no reason for the character to be afraid, and thus no reason for the reader to be afraid for the character. Although Jander is an older vampire than Strahd, Strahd is a tactical genius and a powerful magic user. He has thralls and undead monsters at his command, not to mention the land itself. Perhaps most importantly, Strahd possesses a killer instinct that Jander simply does not. Vampire of the Mists functions more like a mystery than a rip-roaring fantasy yarn. The heart of the narrative is Jander's quest to unravel the secret behind Anna's fate and release her from whatever curse is still binding her to the world of the living. It's only when he realizes Strahd's role in her doom that the narrative alters trajectory and it becomes a more robust good versus evil contest. Unfortunately, the revelation that Strahd is responsible for what happened to Anna isn't much of a revelation. He's really the only character it could have possibly been. Vampire of the Mist is also unique because of how much time passes. From the point when Jander first meets Anna to the night he gets sucked into Barovia, 30 years pass. Then another 10 years pass while Martin grows from a little boy into an adult, and Sasha grows from a zygote into a little boy. After that, it's probably another 15 years or so until Sasha is a full-fledged vampire hunter. That's a minimum of 55 years from beginning to end, not counting the flashbacks to Jander's mortal life, of course. 55 years, that's a huge span of time for any novel. Fantasy novels and horror novels are both dependent on a sense of urgency. Without urgency, there's not much excitement in the case of fantasy, and not much dread in the case of horror. Unfortunately, as a result, there's not much tension in Vampire of the Mists. Jander, our protagonist, is never in any danger right up until the last few chapters, once he's awoken Strahd's wrath. Sasha faces vampires during his nightly hunts, but of course, he's been seeking out that danger by his own choice. He could have just stayed home. The only ticking clock, so to speak, is the suffering the supposed spirit of Anna is enduring beyond her death. Jander's only goal at the outset is to find out what happened to her, and the only impetus to keep searching is Anna's goading. And in the end, it wasn't even really Anna. The last thing I want to discuss today are the two main characters, Jander and Strahd. Jander is a morally ambiguous character, very different from the typical good guy heroes we expect. He hates being a vampire, but he refuses to end his existence until the very end, fearing that he will be transformed into something even worse, a blood-sucking spirit called the Crimson Death that will kill without any mercy or self-restraint. Jander reasons he's less dangerous to the innocent while he still possesses his faculties. Of course, Jander doesn't always possess his faculties. When Anna dies, he goes into such a rage that he murders perhaps dozens of innocent people. When he discovers the truth of what happened to Tatiana/Anna, he flies into another homicidal rage and slaughters an entire flock of innocent sheep. What's strange about Jander is that he doesn't seem too upset by his actions. He might feel bad in the moment, but it doesn't last. Jander is careful never to drink too much blood from any one person, always choosing to spare the person's life if possible, but Jander never seems to feel much remorse for the people he has killed. He hates being a vampire, yes, but it's more about being cut off from the light and from the company of the living. And while Jander may stop himself from committing murder, he makes little to no effort to stop Strahd or Strahd's thralls from doing the same. As I mentioned before, Jander only decides to destroy Strahd once he realizes Strahd's connection to Anna. He's motivated by revenge, not a desire for justice or to protect the innocent. I imagine a younger reader picking up this novel and reading it today might find Jander annoying. He just kind of mopes about and sulks for the majority of the novel. He's too engrossed and brooding to do much except garden and read. But those of us who remember the 90s remember how common this character type was back then. We loved angst-ridden anti-heroes tormented by ennui back then. Just look at Spawn, Fox Mulder, Wolverine, The Crow, Angel, Edward Norton's character from Fight Club, every character from the movie Seven, and probably a million others. Even Stone Cold Steve Austin kind of fit this trope. And lastly, we come to Strahd von Zarevich. Strahd does not brood. Strahd acts. Strahd does not equivocate. Strahd kills. He is very much the anti-Jander, the character driven by pure selfish desire, undiluted by mercy or compassion or love. Strahd is a psychopath of the highest order. In Strahd's mind, the world belongs to him, and so does everyone and everything in it. If Strahd has a weakness, it's boredom. Reigning supreme over an entire domain and all its inhabitants might seem fun at first, but it can be isolating, like when Homer becomes the leader of the Stonecutters and all his friends start worshipping him. Strahd seeks out companions who can keep him entertained. Jander is the most obvious example. He's an outsider to Barovia. For someone living in existence where everything is the same, night after night, Jander is something new and different. Then there's Trina, the werewolf. Strahd has plenty of vampire thralls, but a thrall is kind of a psychic slave, and having a conversation with a thrall must be a lot like talking to yourself. Not exactly stimulating. Trina is her own woman, and Strahd can never predict what she'll do with 100% certainty. Strahd had no idea, for example, that Trina was the one luring his thralls out into the forest to be killed by Sasha and Liesel. Not that he particularly cares about what happens to his thralls. The most tragic example of Strahd using another person for his own amusement is, of course, poor Tatiana. Even before he was a vampire, Strahd was bored. He had accomplished everything he had wanted to accomplish. His enemies were dead, his borders were secure, his people were under his thumb. There was nothing left for him to do except count down the days until his death. Then Tatiana entered his life. She brought that spark of excitement that his life was missing. But, Strahd being Strahd, he couldn't just enjoy having this kind, vivacious woman for a loving sister-in-law. That is not the narcissist's way. He had to possess her. He was even willing to make a pact with the dark powers so that she might belong to him utterly. As Jander points out, that is the opposite of love. Even a century later, Strahd is still trying to possess her. Each time she is reincarnated, he feels that same spark of excitement again, and each time it is snuffed out. My favorite part of the entire book is when Jander discovers Strahd's hidden journals. The inner sanctum where they're hidden is probably the creepiest part of the castle, with an untouched wedding feast rotted on a table, a portrait with a face slashed beyond the point of recognition, and a bizarre shrine to a long-dead woman. The story of Strahd's transformation is truly horrific. Strahd wasn't the innocent victim of circumstance like Jander was. Strahd chose to become what he became, knowing full well the monstrous evil he must commit to do so. He killed his own brother in cold blood, drove Tatiana to suicide, and then committed mass murder when he couldn't have his plaything. There is no redemption possible for Strahd. There isn't even the tiniest little bit of humanity left in him to redeem. He is, quite literally, the devil. And that's what makes him such a fun character. He is evil to the depths of his lack of a soul, and he relishes it. Strahd loves being a vampire. Hunting and killing is all in good fun, and it's honestly hard not to like a character who is always having such a good time, as reprehensible as he might be. It's easy to understand why Strahd is one of the most, if not the most, popular and enduring villain in D&D. He is the kind of bastard you love to hate, and it's very satisfying when you finally get to drive a stake through his heart, even if part of you knows you'll miss him when he's gone. And the story of Strahd's damnation is, in a perverse way, kind of an uplifting one. Strahd the mortal man was miserable and without purpose, leading a gray, dreary life. His transformation into an undead bloodsucker was the best thing that could have happened to him. He became the person he was always meant to be. He may be dead, and he may be a monster, but he does seem genuinely happy. The best comparison I can think of is Arthur Fleck in Joker. He starts out as this pathetic loser, and by the end, he's the world's greatest supervillain. Arthur and Strahd just needed to find their passion, to find out what they were put on this earth to do. We should all be so fortunate. Okay, that's all for today. If you've enjoyed the show and you want to support the podcast, please become a patron by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club. Join me again in a few weeks when we will be discussing the second novel in the Ravenloft series, Night of the Black Rose, by James Lowder. Thank you for listening, and until next time, if your fiancé refuses to be tested for lycanthropy, you should probably just assume they're a werewolf. Thank you.